Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, John Emmerich. With us today is Professor Gerald Epstein, author of the new book, Busting the Bankers Club, Finance for the Rest of Us. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks very much for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, specifically how it led to this topic and you writing this book?
So I teach economics at the University of Massachusetts, and I co-direct a research institute there called the Political Economy Research Institute, which focuses on policy-relevant research. And one of my areas has been finance and central banking. And I was following the great financial crisis, the aspects leading up to it, quite closely with a colleague of mine, Professor Jim Crotty. And when the crisis hit, I pretty much knew it was going to happen because my colleague Jim Crotty told me it was going to happen. He's usually right about these things. But I was really quite worried that the other progressive economists like myself weren't aware of these underlying dynamics and underlying problems, and really weren't going to jump into the fray around financial reform that was going to happen. So I started an organization with a couple of colleagues to try to help mobilize lawyers, economists, and others to work with groups in Washington, like the American for Financial Reform, who were trying to weigh in on the Dodd-Frank financial regulations. And in that process, I realized two things. One, the banks and the big financial institutions have huge resources that they use to support their positions. But I also realized that there was a group of others that were really trying to reform the system and had been working for quite a while. So this group that the banks organize, I call the Bankers Club. And the groups that try to really create a financial system that works better for the rest of us, I call the Club Busters. And I decided to write this book to explain these dynamics and also to try to unpack some of these complex aspects of finance and financial regulation so that regular people in the street can understand it better.
And as they deserve to do. And it's a great book. And I'm going to selfishly take the opportunity now that I have you on the phone to ask some questions that I've been wondering about for the last 15 years, because I was managing money through that crisis, trying to worry about a portfolio while simultaneously figuring out what the heck was going on and what happened. So let's start. Right. The book itself will go through kind of in order, and because it's also a chronology of history. Going back to the Roaring Twenties, not so stable. Stock market collapses into the Great Depression. There are fits and starts, a world war. And then we get this relatively long, stable period in the context of economic history. The New Deal made specific and significant changes, not always equitable to the broad swath of the population in the U.S., as we'll get into. But from a corporate perspective, from a banking and markets perspective, what are the big programs and institutions that came out of the New Deal, and why were they so important?
Right. So there were a number of policies that the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt were able to pass. to try to stabilize the financial system, number one, but also to create a financial system that would serve the real economy, you know, that would lend money to businesses, to households, et cetera, and not primarily serve speculation as it had during the Roaring Twenties. So the first thing that, and probably the best well-known reforms were the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment from commercial banking. That is, investment banking, we think of J.P. Morgan, that was more speculative, and commercial banking, which runs the payments system, which takes deposits and provides banking services for businesses and households. So it separated those two kinds of banking to make sure that the core banking system, the commercial banks, was stable and wouldn't collapse as a result of Ponzi schemes and other speculation taken on by the investment banks. So the separation in the Glass-Steagall Act was one thing. A second thing that was really crucial was deposit insurance, insuring deposits in these commercial banks to reduce the runs on the banks that had caused so many thousands of banks to collapse in the 1930s. And that's number two. But there's some other policies that were passed that are less well understood. One is the idea of creating a mission-guided approach to banking. That is, what the New Deal did was separated financial institutions into different segments and gave them each segment a different mission. So for example, commercial banks to take deposits and lend to businesses and so forth, insurance companies to take in longer term income and lend longer term to municipalities, to businesses and so forth, investment banks to underwrite securities, et cetera. And so each of these segments of the financial system were not only separated from each other, and I'll say a bit more about that in a minute, but they all had missions. The idea being that they understood that banking and finance is a public franchise. Governments charter banks, they regulate financial institutions. So they create a situation where financial institutions can make profits, but in return, there's a quid pro quo. They should provide not only a private mission, but also a social mission. Now, the segmentation of finance during the New Deal is interesting because on the one hand, it created oligopolies and monopolies. That is, limited competition that each of these financial institutions faced. And we all think, well, that's bad. You know, some kind of limitation of competition is bad. But the New Dealers thought that this would stabilize the financial system. If they didn't have to always be competing so much, they wouldn't always be trying to move out on the risk return curve as much as possible. They could have a stable income. Some people called it 3-6-3 banking. Banks would pay depositors 3%, they'd lend out at 6%, and they'd get to the golf course by 3 in the afternoon. It was kind of a low-key sort of boring banking system, but it was stable and it did serve a social mission.
And that falls under an umbrella, I think, of a term that you use in the book, like what's the basic function of banking and where we may have lost our way. I'm going to fast forward all the way through the 70s and Volcker in the 80s and jump to the Clinton administration and Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin and Fed Chairman Greenspan. A couple of big bills that undo Glass-Steagall and more. One is, I think, Graham-Leach-Bliley, and another big one involves the regulation of derivatives, the commodities futures bill. Looked at together, in hindsight, a disaster waiting to happen, and it only took 7 to 8 years. Walk through those pieces of legislation, and there had to be, gosh, people that looked at that and said, you know, that had some historical perspective that were older and seasoned and said, this is a mistake. Or was everyone just caught up in the magic of Alan Greenspan? And I'll get to the fact that, like, Bob Rubin during those days was referred to as the greatest Treasury Secretary since Alexander Hamilton. Walk us through the late 90s and those pieces of legislation, specifically those, and it's, we just talked about the things that they undid from the New Deal.
Right. So, you know, the biggest bankers, the ones that had been running the J.P. Morgans and the Goldman Sachs and so forth, and Citibank, earlier versions of that, and Citibank, they were never happy with this New Deal system. They made decent profits to get to the golf course by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but they really couldn't get the mega profits that and mega incomes that they had all been used to in the roaring 20s and before that. So right from the very beginning, they wanted to try to undermine the system. And that's where the Bankers Club came in. They created allies to help them do this. And little by little, piece by piece, they undermined the system. And that goes way back to the 1960s and 70s when the big banks, Citibanks and others, they moved operations overseas in the Euro-dollar market to try to get around these regulations, started pushing the regulatory agencies to free up their ability to use more derivatives. They pushed for interstate banking rules to allow them to bank across states. This was in the earlier 90s. And they had a kind of a full court press. That is, they pushed the regulatory agencies, they pushed the legislature, and they pushed the courts that passed a number of rules. There's an appendix in my book that goes through all of these that allowed them to do more and more with less and less regulation. But as you said, the crowning point was in the 1990s. Bill Clinton, a Democrat, which really drank the Kool-Aid of Alan Greenspan and the others, who said, we have efficient markets. Talk about financial theory, you know, the efficient markets theory, that regulating finance actually makes the financial system work less efficiently. It hurts not only profits, but the economy as a whole. That was all taken in by by Clinton and his team and Robert Rubin. And so the Federal Reserve played a really important role here. The Federal Reserve took petitions from Citibank, which allowed them to merge with an insurance company. And that was the nose under the tent. And Congress said, well, they're doing this anyway. The Fed is behind this. So let's pass legislation to make it all right and good and permanent. So that's when they passed the law to get rid of Glass-Steagall. And so then that brought about what the big banks had always wanted, their ability to move back to universal banking, where they could do everything under one roof and anywhere in the country, anywhere in the globe, underwrite securities, create derivatives, et cetera. A second piece of legislation that was passed, the Modernization Act, allowed the selling of derivatives without any regulations on them, basically. Brooksley Bourne, who had been the head of one of the regulatory agencies, had tried to stop this, but Rubin and the group didn't listen to her and passed this legislation so that there wouldn't be any regulation on derivatives. So what this basically did was create these universal banks that could do anything they want, pretty much. Got to be so big that the regulators couldn't regulate them. So they decided to institute a policy of self-regulation. And they used complicated models, internal models, to try to convince the regulators that they were safe. And so it was all a black box and self-regulation that we ended up with.
And in researching stuff around this book, I came up with a Wall Street Journal article from 2018 entitled "Bob Rubin's Legacy Up for Debate." It takes some time to see the effects of what these changes made, and he was a champion. I just bring that up to ask you to talk a little bit about the revolving door in bank regulation, because let's be honest, it's not just bank regulation. I have a whole nother career in food and agriculture, and it's the same at the FDA, right? You go from Monsanto to the head of the FDA and back to Monsanto. But give some examples of that revolving door, because I think it's discomforting at best.
You're right. So there's a general concept in political science and political economy called capture theory. That is the idea that regulatory institutions tend to be captured by the industries that they regulate. And this goes all the way back to some economists at the University of Chicago who developed this theory in the 50s. They developed this theory to try to criticize all regulatory agencies and to try so that we could get rid of regulatory agencies. But in fact, it's a little more nuanced than that. So it is true that there are many processes that tend to make regulatory agencies operate in the interests of the industries they regulate. And the revolving door is a main one. The revolving door says the regulatory agency, people who work there, they work there, they develop an expertise, and then they're able to go work for the regulated industry at much higher salaries, and they offer benefits to the regulated industry. They call back their friends, you know, in the regulatory agencies, you know, hey, you know, can you give my company a break, et cetera. And this is a very strong dynamic. It affects all the regulatory agencies, including the Federal Reserve, which right. I call the chairman of the club.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you look at the number of the people, look at, for example, a Silicon Valley Bank, which went bankrupt about a year ago. In a couple of weeks, it would be the year anniversary. And the president of Silicon Valley Bank was on the board of the San Francisco Federal Reserve. It was the San Francisco Federal Reserve that was tasked with monitoring and supervising Silicon Valley Bank. And
so you see right almost there, unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, you see right there this kind of insidious connection between the regulatory agencies and the regulators. Now, I say this doesn't happen all the time. I mean, for example, if you look at the SEC right now and you look at Gary Gensler, who is really trying to regulate very stringently crypto, for example, you know, he's definitely not in the pocket of the crypto industry. So one has to have a bit of a more nuanced view about how this all works.
Right. There's a study you reference in the book that calculates the net benefit to society of what you call roaring banking, and it ends up being a negative number. And candidly, I'm glad the study exists, but I don't think I need to put pencil to paper. Again, having lived through it as a fund manager since 97 and an armchair economist, I look at the majority of Wall Street activity post dismantling Glass-Steagall as adding no value to the street, right? It's whether it's prop trading or investment banking, or which we were talking about fund management before I hit the record button. It seems to inure almost entirely to senior executives and Goldman Sachs partners. But so talk about originate to distribute, that study, excess income, misallocation of resources, and things like that. Tracking all what we've just talked about, this big picture, where we are as of 1999, back to what does it do for us?
What we looked at is kind of a satellite view version of the financial finance of the roaring banking economy and how that influences the real economy. So we looked at three components to try to understand whether it's a net benefit to our economy. The first is a zero sum component. That is, it's just, if you think of the pie and you're breaking it up into the pieces, the zero sum part of it is who gets a bigger piece and who gets a smaller piece. And so we looked at excess profits and excess incomes that go to the big finance industry. And we based it on a study by two economists, Philippon and Reshef, who said, okay, let's first look at incomes of the bankers. Why are they so high? You know, the incomes of bankers are about double they are in the average industry in the economy. Why are they so high? Well, you can imagine a number of reasons that are legitimate. You know, they work harder, they work longer, they're more skilled, it's riskier, so their incomes fluctuate more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of variables that one could account for that. And so what they did is they ran a number of econometric regressions to control for all these variables, which could legitimately explain why their incomes might be higher. And even controlling for all of that, they found that there was their incomes were significantly higher. And so what we did was take that residual, that rent, and we added it up among we added it up over 10 years or so, and found that the rents going to these bankers during that period, you know, $3 to $4 trillion. Similarly with profits, certainly banks need to make profits, but they often don't take into account the risk associated with the profits they make. So there have been a lot of studies which look at what their profits ought to be if you adjust it for the real risk that they incur. Now, this is a problem for the society, because the reason they don't have to adjust their profits for the risk is because they often get bailed out by the Federal Reserve or the Treasury when things go south. So we found that the study showed that the profits, the rate of returns are about half of what they're reported. So we took about, you know, one quarter of it. We didn't cut it down by a half, but we cut it down by a quarter and added that in. So that's the rent part. That is the excess incomes and profits. The second is the misallocation of resources. And this is really how this roaring banking shrinks the pie. It doesn't just redistribute it, it shrinks it. There's an economics literature called Too Much Banking, and it's looked at econometric studies of the size and behavior of banking systems across the world, and found that, and this is very crude, but it found that if private credit as a share of GDP is about 100% of GDP, you increase the size of the financial sector, that actually lowers the rate of economic growth. And in the U.S., you know, we're at about 160% of GDP. And so we calculated, according using their econometric analysis, by how much that reduces our rate of economic growth. And we added that amount. We added it up over the period, and we added that in. Now, you might ask, why does that reduce the rate of economic growth? Well, there are a couple of reasons, but most of the literature says it's because finance sucks in highly skilled, highly educated workers into finance, which over and above their contribution to real economic growth,
right,
and where they could be doing more if they were real engineers and having other kinds of jobs. So we added that in. Finally, the other reason why big unruly financial systems create problems for the economy as a whole is because of financial crises. So we added that in as well. And we came up with a sizable figure that the roaring banking costs our economy.
And you got to the heart of the matter. Now we're getting into the great financial crisis. When you talk about banks structured by the executives to profit the executives, and if things go south, there's someone there to pick up the pieces, which is the taxpayers. And that's, you mentioned John Stewart in the book. It's a line that he always uses. It's privatization of profits and socialization of losses. Pretty succinct way to describe what happened. So here's the selfish part of my time with you. A couple of questions. One of the most fascinating pieces of financial news video, if there is such a thing, and I'm a nerd in this area, so I found it fascinating. I call it the two Bills, Bill Ackman, the hedge fund manager, and Bill Gross, the then bond king. Bill Ackman is in the CNBC studios, and he's talking about his short Fannie Mae position. Bill Gross, who I think just got off a plane from Washington, D.C., landed back in Southern California, is buying those bonds. And the math that Ackman does is finance 101, irrefutable. You know, he's saying, look, if you have $100 of debt and the enterprise value is worth $75, the equity is worth zero, and the debt has to take a haircut, whatever that haircut is, 50%, you know, you do the math to figure out what a sustainable capital structure is going forward. Okay. Bill Gross entertains the debate for about 30 seconds, and then he just cuts him off. He says, I get paid to be right on the trade. I'm going to be right on the trade. I don't know if it was hours or days later, it came out that the government was going to pay off those bonds, you know, basically at 100 cents on the dollar. Now that's, the bondholders didn't take a hit. So now we get to the great financial question, right? we have bankruptcy laws for restructuring. I used to do it as a consultant in the early days with Pete Marwick. There was a similar crisis in the early 90s, if my memory serves, in Scandinavia generally, I think Sweden specifically, where they let, you know, they made investors take the haircut, you know, turn the lights off on Friday at 5 o'clock, restructure the thing. Bondholders, you're getting 50 cents on the dollar of your debt, but you own 100% of the equity. They turn the lights on Monday, and they didn't have that huge overhang of debt from paying everybody off, and growth returned to normal in a fraction of the time that we experienced here after the great financial crisis, which was, you know, 10 years of sluggishness. So the question is, because now you've talked about, you've already given us the background on the setup for the great financial crisis to happen, dismantling Glass-Steagall and the commodities futures bill. Now let's go talk about what could we have done to fix it. And before we get to Dodd-Frank, you know, why did we buy off? And I know Fannie Mae and Freddie are different entities, and they're tied to the health of the housing market. But AIG, okay, and those bonds that got paid off 100 cents of the dollar, all of, I think the majority holder was Goldman Sachs partnership. Like, why did we do that? Was there another way to come out of there? Because now you talk about misallocation of resources. You know, during the Obama administration, I was thinking, you know, $500 billion to upgrade the electricity grid, the smart grid. We're all talking about it. Well, that money went away. That opportunity and opportunities like it went away because all those financial resources went to fixing this problem in a way that I think was overdone. That is a long-winded kind of explanation of what's been obsessing me since 2008. But I'd selfishly love your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree with what you're saying. You know, in a shorthand, when I teach my students about this, and I'll go into a bit more detail in a minute, but the shorthand thing I say to my students is, look, even if at that time they needed to bail out the banks, they didn't need to bail out the bankers. That is, there's no, you know, if you need to have an infrastructure of banking, which you do, it makes the payment system works and it protects households and businesses' deposits and so forth. You know, sure, you need that. That's what our financial system needs. But you didn't need to bail out all of these creditors, all the bondholders, the top officials of these banks that took the money and ran. I mean, look what the Obama administration did with regard to General Motors. General Motors was going bankrupt around the same time. And the Obama administration gave them a lifeline. What did they demand in return? Well, first of all, they demanded they sack their top officials, put in new management. They demanded haircuts from the and support from the labor unions and so forth, and other kinds of changes. What did they demand from the banks? Zippo.
Nothing.
Zero. And I think that has nothing to do with the stability of the banking system and the financial system, and everything to do with the cozy relationships between Robert Rubin and Tim Geithner and all of these people and the bankers themselves. They were scared. Obama was scared. He didn't really know anything about this.
He didn't understand.
So he put his total faith in these guys, including Bernanke, head of the Fed. So what could they have done? Exactly what you said. They could have paid off. They could have taken all of these bondholders and the AIG and all of them to take a major cut. If that led to a run on the banking system, well, they could have dealt with that some other way through liquidity.
We just guaranteed everybody's deposits, unlimited, right?
So they could have done that. I mean, that creates a whole other problem, but they could have done that. So they could have really shifted the whole distribution of the impact of this. And instead, they bailed out the banks, and we could get into this later if you want. But I think that had a very toxic impact on the politics of what we've seen since then. I mean, if you trace the Tea Party came right out of that, and And that morphed into other things that we're seeing now. So I think there was so much anger about that, and it just did not have to happen that way.
And I wrote down this question you've kind of gotten into already, which is, you know, what does the term bailout mean? It just gets thrown around and it's used very generally. Are you bailing out companies? Are you bailing out bondholders? Are you bailing out management? And I actually had the question further down my list about what happened with the auto industry. And I think they also had a repayment plan. Like, I think the government got some of that money back.
Yeah, they did.
So is there a number specific to the Great Financial Crisis where you know the ins and outs to find out how much, just from that, how much kind of permanent loss of the nation's equity, if you will, was spent without, again, where you and I are in agreement, without any incremental return benefit to society? I'm losing the thread here, but how much money just, you know, disappeared into the banks and the bondholders and the management team just from the GFC as a net? Like, for instance, we said, like with the auto guys, they got over time. If you looked and you did the debits and credits and the inflows and outflows, you're like, it worked out. It was a fair deal all around. And I think society probably was well served. But is that analysis been done for Wall Street and the GFC alone?
Yeah. So the net issue is interesting and difficult. Okay. But let me first talk about gross and then we can talk about net. So some economists at the Levy Institute went through it in great detail. This was a long time ago, 10, 15 years ago, and came up with a figure of 20, that bailout gross was about $27 trillion or $29 trillion, something like that. Now, if you talk to Fed officials and Treasury officials, they say, well, but it was all paid back. The thing is, though, if you think about the rate of return that the government demanded on these bailouts, it was very, you know, they had to pay back a number of these things. It was a tiny, it was a very low rate of return. It wasn't a risk-adjusted rate of return. And the government and the society bore tremendous risk in doing this.
Right.
The net figures that I have seen, if you take into account what was repaid and so forth, with an appropriate discount rate and all that, it comes more to like $12 trillion, something like that. But there's always going to be a debate about the net because it depends on what you think the counterfactual was and what the real cost of this bailout should have been to the people who got it. I think anywhere from $12 to $27 trillion is the answer.
Yeah, and that's what I was just going to say. Whether it's 12 or 27, it's a staggering sum of money when you look at the bickering over costs that would benefit the bottom half of the country economically. It's insane. You know, Churchill said, "Never let a crisis go to waste," but we did. I already referred to kind of the opportunity to have greened the economy. Now we've waited 15 years, precious years. We don't get back to start that. We got Dodd-Frank. But there's a difference I now know from reading your book, I didn't really understand, between a bill and the rulemaking.
Yeah.
And other than the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which I know you were a fan of, what happened to Dodd-Frank? And it doesn't seem like it really fixed the institutional problems that led to the Great Financial Crisis. But I'll let you pass judgment.
That's right. Well, it didn't. And for a number of reasons. First of all, as we've been talking about Obama and Geithner and Larry Summers and Rubin and so forth, their goal was not to fundamentally, they did not want to fundamentally restructure the financial system. They did not want to reinstitute a modern Glass-Steagall Act. They didn't want to put a cap on the size of the banks or break them up. They wanted to let them remain too big to fail. They didn't want to really regulate the whole financial system, including hedge funds and all of these. They didn't want to make executives pay back their ill-gotten gains with clawbacks and so forth. They wanted to allow them to continue to take the money and run. What they just wanted to do was get the banking system back to the point where it was running again, where people would have confidence in it, and where it could pretty much continued to do what it was doing. The one a strong internal law that they were good, that they did pass but didn't really implement, was the Volcker rule. Paul Volcker, the earlier head of the Fed, really was very critical of all these financial speculation of the big banks. Even though he was a hawk on inflation, he really didn't like this freewheeling, roaring banking. And the Volcker rule was designed to reduce the proprietary trading of banks that was so speculative and got them into so much trouble. Obama reluctantly agreed to put that in, but it never went anywhere. Okay, so they really just never intended to do much structurally with the banks. But what they did do, the few things, they were just a broad outline of rule. Then they set up this situation where these broad outlines had to be written into particular regulations and particular rules. So they created this, 10-year rulemaking process. And this was done because the banks knew that after Obama signed the law, that the bank, the club busters, for the most part, the people who were trying to make sure this was done correctly, they would lose funding. They'd kind of fade a bit into the background. And the bankers themselves, the bankers club, would have free rein on the rulemaking process. And so they spent hundreds of millions of dollars to make sure that these rules Swiss cheese. I mean, they had so many holes
right,
in them.
Right.
And then when the Trump administration came in, they weakened them even further. So unfortunately now we see that once again, when there's a major financial crisis, that we have major financial crises, potentially like after the COVID pandemic was announced in March of 2020, the global financial system almost melted down again. We had the Silicon Valley Bank last year and others. So it wasn't fixed at all, partly because the Obama administration didn't really intend to fix it, and partly because the little bit they did try to put in was wiped away by the rulemaking process done by from the efforts of the Bankers Club.
Yeah, and always under the guise of we need experts. So these are experts. Expertise is going to fix it, and it's the revolving. It's not even a revolving door. It was just direct handover of control.
This thing about expertise, though, is such an important part of what I try to write about in the book, because the question is what is expertise? Expertise for whom? I mean, if you look, for example, at some of the regulators that President Biden has tried to appoint. So, for example, to head the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, he nominated somebody named Saleh Omarova, who was a law professor at Cornell, who worked, in the Treasury for a while, who's expert, absolute expert on finance and financial regulation. But the Republicans on the committee, joined by a couple of the Democrats on the Senate Banking Committee, they forced her to withdraw. They accused her of being a communist because she's originally from Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
But no, she's a top expert. They just didn't want that kind of expertise.
Right.
The same thing with Sarah Bloom Raskin, also was nominated for a top position. She had worked in the Treasury Department and the White House, a top expert. She was canceled out as well. She's an expert. They didn't want that kind of expertise. So expertise is really just a cover for people who are going to weigh in on their side.
Yeah, that was a shameful part of the story, listening to how they were railroaded out of contention for important positions. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on now. I think people would find your views interesting because monetary policy looms so large. We've had a very long expansion. Powell is, everyone hangs on his every word. When is easing going to start? If it's going to start, do you think the playbook for central banking, now we're getting to just the monetary policy piece, changed over the last 20 years? I did an interview with a professor in the UK, Jonathan Haskell, about his two books on calls The Rise of the Intangible Economy and how it's changed the way we measure productivity. We think about interest rate management and managing the economy. we had an historically fast rise in interest rates out of the Fed, and not a ton happened. He crushed housing. He wanted to crush housing prices, I guess, when you talk about, you know, what, but he, all he did was kill the new home market at a time when we have 3+ million household shortfall, not an overhang like in 2008. Counterproductive, if you ask me, because homeowners equivalent rent is a pretty sticky component of the headline inflation number we see right now. Has the monetary piece of Fed activity changed? Like, are we using a playbook from the 70s that doesn't work quite as well as it may have?
You know, that's a really fascinating question. And I don't think anybody really completely understands what happened in this last episode. I know that I was predicting that the rapid increase in interest rates was going to cause some serious problems, maybe even a recession. And most of my colleagues were predicting the same thing. And obviously, it hasn't happened yet. And the question is, you know, is there something fundamentally different now than was going on before, and which makes monetary policy less effective in this way? And there may be, for sure. I mean, with all the innovations in finance, the huge credit flows around the globe that are outside the banking system and so forth, certainly suggests that the financial markets are harder and harder to control through the standard tools of monetary policy. I will point out, though, since I'm a bit on the older side here, and I remember in the 1970s and 1980s, when there was a discussion about the Fed losing control over the financial markets, and that the only way they could cause a slowdown was to by creating a credit crunch. And Albert Wojenlauer, I don't know if you ever came across that name, an investment banker in New York, wrote a number of really interesting pieces on how monetary policy really works. It's not through just raising interest rates, but there actually has to be some credit rationing going on somewhere in the system to just cut off credit to key users. Because when you raise interest rates, they can often just raise that in prices and recapture it.
Pass it on. Yeah.
But I think the problem with the recent episode is also that the Federal Reserve mistook a demand side inflation problem for what was really a supply side
shock.
And central banks have never been really well designed to deal with supply side shocks. And so what they do is they see a supply side shock. They don't want to implement the tools that they have to deal with the supply side shock. And I can get back to that in a minute. And so they implement demand side policy, raising interest rates and so forth, which typically would create major problems for the economy and so forth, but isn't really dealing with the fundamental problem. So when there are really serious supply side shocks, the central bank, I believe, has to develop tools to limit the price increases in the sectors that are having problems, but support increased supply in those sectors at the same time. And unfortunately, central banks really can't do this by themselves. Central banks have to coordinate with governments that are trying to deal with supply side shocks. Now, this runs really into a very strong controversy about the role of so-called central bank independence. That is, what does that mean? Is that something that's a good thing to have, the way it's structured now? Or should central banks really cooperate more with governments that are trying to deal with these stickier economic problems like supply side inflation or making a transition to a fossil-free energy system and so forth? Do we need central banks to be more cooperative with governments in trying to solve these big problems? And this is something I talk about in my book, but I know it's quite controversial.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I joke all the time that, like, I follow as many former economists who are now strategists. I say, if you ask three of them what their favorite inflation metric is to follow, you wouldn't get three different answers. You'd get nine, you know, PCE, CPI, core, mean, trim mean. And then, of course, it's influenced by all these human interventions like homeowners equivalent rent and hedonics and technology and quality. You know, I just, it seems almost a fantasy that, you know, and then what's magical about 2%, you know, this target and the headlines drive me nuts. You know, if there's a avian flu and 50 million chickens get killed and egg prices triple, they invoke, like, is the Fed supposed to do something? Like, seriously, it's supposed to raise rates because right. of that? It's insanity. But I want to get to the chapter that shares the name of the book, Busting the Bankers Club, and get you talking about what we need to do and how realistic you think it is. You know, you start with three objectives. And the first one, reduce frequency and severity of financial crises. I mean, you tell me, we already had Dodd-Frank. What can be done? What should be done? And what's the prospects of things changing unless one party with an interest in doing so controls basically all three pieces of government?
Well, so yeah, let's talk about financial stability and financial regulation. In some ways, I think that's the easiest piece. I have three components. One, more financial and better financial regulation, number one. Number two, more publicly oriented financial institutions, public banks, and more mission-guided finance, that's number two. And number three, to help make any of this happen, we need to protect our democracy writ large. Of these three different components, and I have a chapter on each of them in towards the end of my book, financial regulation really is the easiest because that's something that we're used to talking about. That's something the government is used to doing. They have fumbled it, but it's a language that regulatory agencies, Congress people, and bankers and economists understand. So let's just take one simple example: capital regulation. I mean, that's something that's on the table right now. They're trying to increase and make more uniform, stricter capital regulation for banks. This is a part of the Basel approach to capital regulation and so forth. And that's a no-brainer. I mean, we have to make the banks hold more equity on their balance sheet so that if things go south, then they're the ones who are put at risk. And it's not a panacea. It's not the all to end all. But they're fighting this tooth and nail. But I do think there are that the central banks, some members of Congress, are really, and people in the Treasury are supporting capital regulation because that seems like a basic form of creating more financial stability. So I'm kind of hopeful about that side. But that's not enough. We also need more leverage rule. And the reason we need that is because the value of capital on a bank's balance sheet is very pro-cyclical. When the economy is booming, you know, the equity prices of banks go up, and so the value of capital goes up. So banks feel like they can lend more. So they lend more into the boom or invest more into the boom when it goes down, the opposite. Whereas if you have leverage requirements that are really about the amount of debt that the bank is taking on, that can be less pro-cyclical. And I think that has to be increased. And I guess that's something that was part of Dodd-Frank. There were some increased leverage rules. But what happened was they put those in just for the very biggest banks. Under the Trump administration, they lowered it down the minimum size for banks. And that's how Silicon Valley Bank got under that leverage rule and the capital rule. So they need to lower it again because these mid-sized banks like Silicon Valley Bank was need that kind of regulation. So those are two things. A third thing, though, and this is going to be harder, but I think people are recognizing this at the Fed and elsewhere, you need to have an umbrella that has all of financial markets and institutions under some form of monitoring and regulation. You know, the Fed says we have to keep bailing out the whole financial system. We at least have to know what's going on there and have some regulations. So again, that's something that I think is likely to happen. Breaking up the banks, it's not on the table.
It's not going
to
happen.
Cutting them down to size, not on the table. So that's where I'm more pessimistic. but I think we can make the banking system safer.
Yeah, you talked about leverage. And before, again, before I hit record, I was making jokes at the expense of defining risk in the public equity markets as short-term price volatility. Leverage is a great measure, has a great impact anyway on risk. And I can tell you my work is in the 40 Act oversight world. I still don't think the SEC has the right concept around how options are used and what they represent in terms of notional value. You know, you can have $1,000 of options that represent $10,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 of notional value of securities, and that's leverage. Let's get into what finance does to inequality in the United States and how we address it. I didn't realize that the big banks participate somewhat in what you call fringe finance, and I certainly didn't realize the extent of it, but feel free to talk, because it presents itself frequently in the book. I know it's important to you. It's important to me. It should be important to everybody, because that's the majority of the country. Doesn't exist, but you know, it's the majority of the country is between Manhattan and San Francisco. So talk a little bit about equity in financial services.
Yeah. So I use the term in my book, you know, finance is an engine of inequality, and roaring banking is an engine of inequality in our country these days. There are a number of different ways in which that's true, but focusing, you know, the high salaries of the CEOs and the top management that is subsidized by government bailouts on a regular basis. So that's one area. But another area is just lacking financial services, failing to provide financial services to so many communities of color in certain neighborhoods and so forth, which then force these communities to use fringe banking, you know, day lenders and pawnbrokers, cash checkers and all that, yeah, where the fees are just outrageous. And what we found is that the big banks, the core banks, sometimes are connected to some of these fringe lenders. So they're making, you know, money on the side there. But there's a huge number of underbanked in our society. And there are communities that can't get small business loans, that can't get an investment into the communities. And that's what the Community Reinvestment Act was for. The Community Reinvestment Act was passed in the 1970s to try to encourage banks, force banks that wanted to merge or had some other kind of needed some regulatory forbearance, they were forced to lend more to these communities, small businesses and so forth, and that had a positive impact. Now this was diluted over the years, but recently a new Community Reinvestment Act was passed in the Biden administration, and so this is an example of a government regulation that is pushing the financial institutions to do more for the poor communities, communities of color, and so forth. And there ought to be also, but to move further into this mission-guided finance, public finance that I was talking about before, we ought to really have something like Fed accounts, free accounts that anybody can have at the Federal Reserve. Or we could have revive the postal banking system. You know, the United States used to have a postal banking system until around 1964. There are postal banking systems all over Europe where households can have low cost or free banking accounts subsidized by the government and payment services and so forth subsidized by the government or low cost or free. And in order to make finance more of an engine of equal opportunity, more of an engine of level playing field, and less an engine of inequality. But I also argue that we need more mission-oriented finance. So examples of that include public banking. There's a bunch of public banking groups around the country.
North Dakota's one, right? You mentioned in the book.
So there is a public bank. We actually have two. One is in North Dakota, which was started in 1919 during the populist era. Outgrowth of the populist era of the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s. And there's actually one that was passed more recently in Guam, of all places. So, but anyway, and the Bank of North Dakota operates on what's called the partnership banking model. It doesn't take deposits directly from households. It doesn't lend directly to businesses. It lends through banking institutions like community banks and small banks and so forth, who then on lend these cheaper funds to businesses and households. It's a good model, and that's what they're trying to do in California, in Massachusetts, in Colorado, are trying to promote these partnership banking, public banking models.
I think what numbs my mind in listening to the last couple of stories you've told is the fixes don't require you to be a visionary. Like, the pieces have all existed throughout history, whether you talk about the Postal Service, where you talk about what's going on in North Dakota, whether I talk about Sweden, you talk about 363, and another time we'll talk about, other countries have all this already in place. You know, I've heard people joke that being a banker in Germany is like running a utility. You know, it's very simple, and some of that could be cultural, which is another book. But it has existed at some point in time. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to be a visionary. I'm gonna two more questions. One, because I'm hoping more than just economic nerds like me read this book and listen to the podcast. This is about movie reviews. You reference Margin Call a few times in the book. Why do you like that movie so much? What did it get right? Is it better than The Big Short? You know, why did you bring it up so much?
I talked about movies probably because I've been teaching this class to my students called Finance and Society, and I always have them watch movies about finance. And first of all, I asked them to come up with, I'm dying to get some movies that have a favorable portrayal of bankers, and can't really come up with them. The one they come up with is It's a Wonderful Life, but that's, you know, from 1946. But my favorite is Margin Call, because I want my students and I think it's important for everybody to grapple with the moral dilemmas. You know, what's right, what's wrong? It's not just about maximizing profit. And you see these people in Margin Call, these bankers, knowing that if they just sell all these toxic assets to their customers, that's wrong. They know that's wrong.
Right.
And some of them are actually grappling. What am I going to do? And in the end, they all end up doing it. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. But I just wanted my students to really understand that there are these moral dilemmas, and that individuals can make moral choices about whether they want to be a part of this system or not.
You know, one last thought. Another correlation to my work many years ago in food and agriculture, we have a term in that world called a food desert, which is very similar to what you described in the lack of basic banking services within certain geographic and ethnic communities. It's the same thing. There are people and communities that don't have a decent grocery store to buy healthy food. They're shopping at the gas station on the corner. So, Professor, this has been wonderful. What didn't we talk about that you'd like readers to contemplate, think about, and know about before we sign off for the day? Something I should have asked but didn't.
No, you asked great questions. All I would say is, if people are interested in becoming finding out more about the club busters, the people who are trying to reform our system, go to Americans for Financial Reform, AFR, or Better Markets, or look out to see if there's a public banking operation in your state or your locale. There's lots of different ways to get involved. I think the more people we have that are really trying to reform the system, the more likely it is that we might get someplace. So join the Club Busters, I guess, is my message.
That's a great point. You know, people should look up who Dennis Kelleher is, what AFR does, and learn about Better Markets and things like that. So, Professor, this has been wonderful. Thank you very much for your time. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much.